Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live Sunday, May 8th, 2005, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, and it is truly beautiful today. Today's going to be a very special show for us. They're all special, but this is one we've been waiting for, I think, really since the show began over 3 years ago. Our guest today, arguably the greatest investigative journalist of our era, Seymour Hersh, joining us live today on Media Matters. Prepare to be educated and entertained and learn from the master. Seymour Hersh today on Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Growing conservative attacks on U.S. public broadcasting has some of the public up in arms and calling for a house cleaning. Much of the criticisms focused on the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Kenneth Tomlinson. The CPB is a major source of funding for public radio and TV stations, so Tomlinson and the Republican majority on the CPB board wield a lot of power over the networks as a whole. Tomlinson stands accused of orchestrating a campaign with the help of staff in the White House to smear NPR and PBS programs and personalities with the brush of liberal bias. But Jeff Chester, executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy, says every time Tomlinson's tried to find evidence of this liberal bias, he's come up short. In 2002 and 2003, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting conducted several surveys and focus group sessions to gauge public perceptions about public broadcasting, and the results were not what Tomlinson expected.
The overwhelming majority of Americans don't perceive any bias on NPR or PBS. Indeed, PBS is the most highly rated of all the television networks in terms of confidence from the public.
Specifically, more than half those polled found PBS and NPR news to be more trustworthy than news from other TV and radio networks. Majorities also found both PBS and NPR to be, quote, fair and balanced. Focus group sessions held in 2003 were even comprised exclusively of people who believed that public broadcasting has a liberal bias. But by and large, hardly any focus group members could cite specific examples of bias in public radio or TV programming. So the CPB simply mothballed the results of its research. Chester found this information buried deep inside a CPB report to Congress. The legislation that created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting contains a provision requiring it to remain nonpartisan. Several public interest groups have called for Tomlinson's resignation, claiming he's violated the anti-partisan provision. There's also been a call for nationwide public hearings on public broadcasting, the idea being to build up grassroots opposition to CPB leadership. But Chester's not sure just how effective that tactic may be.
Defending the status quo at PBS is not really going to improve the quality of the U.S. media environment. I mean, after all, if we put a tremendous amount of energy in, what do we get? More antique roadshows and the occasional front line?
In related news, the new president and CEO of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is not a viewer or listener like you. Ken Faree, the former architect of the FCC's failed crusade in 2003 to allow more consolidation among newspapers, radio, and TV stations, recently told the New York Times he doesn't watch much public television and never listens to public radio.
Last month, Intel made headlines for being the first chip maker to announce that its future products would be WiMAX compliant. The term WiMAX refers to a new generation of wireless networking technology that operates at high power levels, as much as 25 times what current Wi-Fi networks use. Sasha Meinrath, a project coordinator with the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network, says Wi-Fi and WiMAX were initially supposed to operate on separate chunks of the radio spectrum.
And then in January of 2003, the industry groups introduced an amendment to the standard. And what this means now is that these two technologies, Wi-Fi and WiMAX, which used to be complementary and non-overlapping, now overlap completely.
That's a troublesome change because wireless networking at low power levels has advantages over a high power system. Current Wi-Fi technology is cheap and plentiful enough so that networks can be constructed by end users directly.
WiMAX itself is really set up as a hub and spoke technology where you have a central tower, let's say, and a lot of receivers like cell phones.
Meinrath says the standard setting process is not very transparent. He tried contacting the WiMAX Forum, whose members include more than 100 corporations ranging from electronics manufacturers to phone companies, about becoming involved in the debate. but quickly learned he couldn't afford the price of admission.
You have to just pay a token fee of $10,000 a year to be a part of this alliance.
Ultimately, what once might have extended the usefulness of wireless networking is now being developed as a ploy to get consumers to buy more and newer gadgetry.
The goal of industry is to have a timeline for obsolescence of old technologies. Not that they're bad, but rather you can have everyone buy the new technology.
There is no clear timetable for the development and deployment of WiMAX technology, although a consensus estimate places its debut sometime in 2006.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
They are indeed. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on Sunday, May 8th, 2005, from the studios of WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Boy, is it beautiful today. Before we get started with today's show, I just want to give an update to our great listeners who last week again showed their phenomenal support for both WILL and for this program, Media Matters. We managed to get, as it turned out, 129 people calling in to make pledges for a total cash total, I think, was well over $8,000, basically 7% of the total amount raised by WILL AM and FM came through our one program. It's 2 hours out of the 336 or whatever it was that were broadcast during the pledge drive on the two stations combined. So I can't say enough in the way of thank you for your support, listeners to WILL and listeners to Media Matters. And I think today is one of the great reasons why we get so much support for this show here at WILL. We're joined as our guest today on Media Matters by Seymour Hersh. Seymour Hersh is an investigative journalist and author who contributes regularly to The New Yorker on military and security matters. He is well known to most followers of American journalism and American politics. Seymour Hersh first gained worldwide recognition in 1969 for exposing the My Lai massacre and its subsequent cover-up during the Vietnam War. He has been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. His most recent book is Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. He's also the author of one of the truly outstanding books of our of recent times, The Price of Power, Kissinger and the Nixon White House. It is an honor to welcome Seymour Hersh to Media Matters. Mr. Hersh?
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning that book. That's one of my favorites.
It was truly a definitional book for me personally when I read it, and it's an extraordinary bit of research. And I wish every American could read that book.
Well, every American didn't. It's awfully dense, I have to tell you. Four chapters on arms control. I learned something.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about your work, Seymour Hersh, that I think really jumps out is that you go after people in power. I mean, you really get after and expose the disparity between what they say and what they do. And Richard Pearl, I have a quote here that Richard Pearl said, "You're the closest thing to American journalism that American journalism has to a terrorist."
Yeah, well, that was after I'd written an article that it sort of unveiled some of his financial ambitions when he was head of something called the Defense Policy Board, sort of the most significant outside advisory board to the Pentagon and to the government. And, of course, being one of the original neoconservatives, he was very influential. At the same time, he's giving that advice to the president and the Secretary of the State and the Secretary of Defense. He's in private business and Homeland Security trying to hustle up business from the Saudis, who as somebody who's very close to Israel and very pro-Israel, which is absolutely his right, he's always been denouncing the Saudis. So to find him in bed with the Saudis was delicious.
I guess he didn't want that door opened, I gather.
No, I don't think so. So that equals terrorism. That's not much of an insult.
Well, 30 years ago, you would have been a communist for that.
You know, you've made the point that's important, and that's the important thing about what he said. What he was doing was essentially red baiting me. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age, it is the exact, I have to commend you, the first person to publicly ever say, which I don't talk about it, but clearly 30 years ago, you were 40 years ago, he might have called me a communist, and the House Un-American Activities Committee might have had me there. Now, of course, the word is, the red bait word is terrorist. So it wasn't an accident he used that phrase.
Now, is it true that back in the 1970s, Dick Cheney came after you as well? There's a story going around that he tried to have you jailed back in the 70s.
Yeah, well, it's not a story. It's actually, I don't know if it's ever been, it's been published in academic books. During the 2000 campaign, I got a call from a bunch of reporters at Newsweek who had gone into the Gerry Ford Library and gone through, you know, I think many documents in the White House or national security documents are automatically declassified after 30 years. And they discovered, or 25 years, I think, whatever it is, they discovered that in 1975 they found a file about me. Cheney and Rumsfeld had both been working very hard to get me prosecuted for a story I'd written about American intelligence activities involving submarines off the coast. We were using submarines to spy on Russia and other countries, get into the off the coast and go in inside the, there's a 3-mile legal limit that everybody recognizes. Other countries insist on 12, but we recognize 3. But nonetheless, our submarines would go secretly inside the 3-mile range and plug in the phone lines and intercept stuff. And I wrote about it in 74, 75, only because other people in the community, in the intelligence community, thought it was madness, crazy, unproductive, very high risk. And we had other means of getting the intelligence. And then they began a full-scale investigation, and Cheney, in a handwritten memo, asked the FBI to consider going into my home, my apartment or home. And the Attorney General, Ed Levy, who had been the dean of the University of Chicago Law School, oh, would we have somebody of that integrity right now, wrote back a memo, and it's in the file, which is in the library, wrote back a memo to Cheney and Rumsfeld and said, you know what, guys, you cannot order an FBI investigation of anybody. That's my job. You can ask me to look at it, and I'll decide, but the idea that you think you can send people into people's homes is ludicrous. I've looked at it, and we'll decide, and they eventually decided not to open an investigation on me, or at least not to go ahead with one. What's amazing to me about it is Newsweek told me about it with great energy in the campaign of 2000, never wrote a story about it.
Yeah, it's amazing that hasn't become a story. What an astonishing statement about Dick Cheney.
You know, it's not that he investigated me. I can understand being angry about a secret being leaked and wanting to get to it. It's that he had so little understanding of his limits of his power. And, you know, you can really see it now. There's no limits now.
We're talking to Seymour Hersh today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Seymour Hersh is the journalist, reporter, writing frequently for The New Yorker, who's been covering military and security matters more closely than any investigative journalist in recent years. And we're going to be talking about his work on Iraq and the Middle East and Iran and U.S. Global policy today. If you'd like to call in, we do have phone lines open, the number 333-9455. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Seymour Hersh will be in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. Tuesday at 5 o'clock, he will be giving the keynote address for the conference on Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation, 5 o'clock to 6:30 in Folinger. Please be sure to attend. It's free and open to the public. Then Wednesday morning, he will be on the first session of the panel, then at 9 a.m., alongside a host of other terrific journalists, including Naomi Klein. So please be sure to come to Folinger Tuesday night here on the University of Illinois campus at 5 p.m. to see Seymour Hersh, and then he'll be here also Wednesday morning, 9 a.m., both events free and open to the public. So please do attend. Seymour Hersh, you know, I've been reading your articles and some interviews with you recently, and there's a comment, the striking comment you make about this administration, which you say basically the American government's been hijacked by neoconservatives, and it's in a context of which you're basically saying there, any comparison of this administration and where it's at to the Nixon administration, it's doesn't quite grasp the fundamental difference between the two. This one is far darker.
Well, I don't think there's any question. I mean, this one, you can't, you know, we've never had and Nixon was an amateur in comparison to how he handled the press. I think the important thing about Nixon and even Johnson was that I, as a journalist, felt that if you wrote a good story, Mili, for example, or other stories on us at the New York Times about not only Watergate, about the CIA and Chile and domestic spying, the government responded to that. And they cared about what was being said. It wrote and written about them, and they cared about trying to posture themselves as always being on the right side. And, of course, when I do that stuff, I always think I'm virtuous, and that's wonderful. But, you know, the difference here is this guy, this president, absolutely believes he is just as virtuous in what he's doing and bringing democracy, quote-unquote, to the Middle East, to the countries he wants to bring it to, which is, of course, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and what they used to call occupied Lebanon before the Syrians left. And so he thinks he's absolutely virtuous. He thinks this is absolutely something he must do, that whether he's judged now or in 10 or 20 years or 50 years for the wonderful president he is, he will come out that way. And therefore, two things are sort of fascinating about that, fascinating or depressing. One is, of course, it doesn't matter how many body bags more come back. Not that he doesn't care. I have no idea what's in his mind. I assume he cares as much as anybody about casualties, but he thinks it's for the greater good. And so another 1,000 American deaths, and God knows nobody counts the Iraqis anyway. And the other thing is, he's not available to me and my colleagues in the journalism business, you know, and to the New York Times or the Washington Post or the networks. We can't affect him. We can't change what he's doing. He is going to do what he's going to do, and he's absolutely inert. As I'm sure many of your audience know, I've been writing an alternative history, more or less, for 3 or 3.5 years in the New Yorker, and, you know, hasn't made a dent.
See, Mahershala, you know, you just mentioned it, that he really believes in this stuff, because one of the debates that we've had on this program that our guests and our experts have talked about is the degree of lying that is going on, conscious lying to get us into this war, whether it be about weapons of mass destruction or about the links of Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attacks. Is Bush, do you think, a liar? Do you think the truth just doesn't – I mean, how does this stack? Is he a conscious liar? Does he believe what he's doing? Or?
Well, I mean, of course, nobody really knows what goes on inside somebody else's head, and I can't presume to know that. I really do believe – you know, I believe his motive for doing what he's doing. I really think he thinks that he's doing – whether he's doing God's work or the work that his father didn't do. I think the work that the neocons think is essential – by going into Iraq, is the notion of responding to Osama bin Laden by going into Iraq is so crazy. You know, Osama bin Laden, most people don't pay that much attention to it, but when the first Gulf War took place in 1991, when Saddam invaded, in the summer of 1990, when Saddam invaded Kuwait, bin Laden had just finished up with his fellow Mujahideen, you know, jihadists in the war in Afghanistan. And he ran back to his home, Saudi Arabia, and volunteered the services of his people and himself in the war against Saddam, who was considered to be a secular infidel. And he wanted to go after Saddam, and said the Saudis refused him, rebuffed him, and took instead the American soldiers to come and stay, which was in the long run turned out to be one of the battle cries of one of the battle cries of Saddam, of Osama, rather, the infidels, the Americans were living in the nation of Mecca and Medina. And so, but to think that Osama bin Laden in any way had any use for Saddam is simply shows a complete lack of understanding, not only of history, but also of who bin Laden is and what he stands for. So the response of this president to the 9/11, to this crazy attack by these crazy people who fly airplanes into our buildings to kill the infidels, us, that the notion that you're going to respond by going to Iraq is so crazy. And so it's going to be the worst decision ever made by an American president. But Bush believes in democracy. What do you think is going on right now in Kyrgyzstan and Ukraine and Georgia? This is, you know, I hope, you know, the United States is, you know, we're players in this stuff, the bringing of democracy to the former Soviet Union. Whether the person that's going out and the person that's replaced are much different, you know, whether real democracy exists. And the same for Iraq, the notion that in Iraq, you have an election that he calls the democratic. Nobody in Iraq voted for a candidate that represented them. The vote was all along sectarian lines. They were voting their religion. That's all it was, from the beginning to the end. Nobody voted. There was no election. There was no election in the sense that you voted for a local assemblyman or congressman. You didn't vote. All you did is you voted for a slate that represented a sectarian point of view. It was so far from anything amounting to an election. Democratic election, but the White House spins it and most people accept it.
We're talking to Seymour Hersh today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you May 8th, 2005, from our studio in Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Seymour Hersh, the number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Robert from San Francisco, you're on the air with Seymour Hersh.
Yeah, I guess this is Mother's Day. I don't have my mother anymore, but one thing about her was that I loved about her was she hated liars, especially politicians that are liars, and I hope I keep up her tradition and honor her that way this day. But anyway, I'm calling quickly because, Mr. Hersh, I respect you so much for what you've done to expose things about Abu Ghraib. You have a nose for news, and you understand investigative journalism, but I wonder if you might comment about others out there who exposing things. I've somewhat lost faith with Michael Rupert's ideas. They seem to be a little stilted. But how about David Ray Griffin? Could you comment about maybe what he's talking about when he is discussing things about the 9/11? And one last thing. I just heard Ben Scott on our local Sunday Salon with Larry Binsky here in the Bay Area. That's a great show, and he did a great job. That's my comment this morning.
Well, thank you very much, Colin. Yes.
Well,
Seymour?
I don't think it's for me to make judgments, and I just don't like to do it. I mean, I'm bucking this a little bit. I know some of the work. I think there are a lot of people in blog land, and I'm one of those. I think blogs are invaluable. They're interesting. I commend the Juan Coles, University of Michigan professor's informed comment. I think it's called on who does sort of a daily blog on the events in Iraq, and he knows Arabic, and he seems to be wise. A lot of the other people who do stuff and sometimes are synergistic in the sense that 2 and 2 sometimes becomes 22, and so in general, I think blogs are new. There's a long way to go with them, and some of the wool, you know, it's. I just can't. I'm not that big of a conspiracy theorist. I don't think you have to work very hard to understand what's going on. It's right in front of us. You know, when I'm talking about the president, I say I don't know whether he's a liar or not. I think he believes what he believes, but somehow that's not the right way to look at it, because the net effect of what happens is a misstatement, an untruth, and a lack of information. And I will tell you that when it gets to the Pentagon, and some of the things that are going on there, I don't think there's ever been a time in recent history that I remember, and I've been in Washington about 40 years, when there's been as much systematic distortion and misinformation, and I guess you could use the word direct lying, manipulation of the facts.
You've been writing about what's happening with intelligence and how it is basically the functions of the State Department and CIA have been sort of lessened and taken over by more directly partisan and political operatives in the White House and within the administration. This seems to be a major development in this administration. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the most important, significant development in the last the CIA, for all of its troubles, and I've been a terrible critic of the CIA and its covert operations, the notion that we have somehow an inherent right to operate against countries we don't appreciate, the Cold War mentality that went on. It still goes on. As critical as I've been about the CIA for its operational capabilities and failures, I also value the fact that it has an awful lot of very bright employees who do intelligence analysis as opposed to operational stuff. And the intelligence analysis often is very good and often was very distressing to the White House, to Cheney, the vice president, and to the president, because they often disagreed. For example, many people in the CIA did not believe there were nuclear weapons despite in Iraq. And, you know, there's a widespread assumption that everybody in the government accepted that as a fact. It's not true. But in any case, they've been completely devalued in the last year by this administration. One of the great victories, one of the great procedural things that's happened, is that the Pentagon has now more or less won the right from the president to operate covertly and do operations with military guys without congressional approval. The way the White House sees the law is very clear. If the CIA runs a covert or clandestine undercover operation, in which Americans are operating not as Americans, they must get approval
The president has to state what they're doing in writing, and the Congress, the Democrats and leading members of the House and Senate have to approve. If it's done in the Pentagon, this White House has made a determination that anything done out of the military can be seen as preparing the battlefield and therefore would be in the purview of the constitutional right of the president as commander-in-chief, and therefore doesn't need to be briefed to Congress or a finding has to be written. So what they've done is they simply moved many things into the Pentagon. And the other thing that's happening that I will tell you is going on with increasing frequency that makes my job almost impossible is they're going off the shelf. They're using retired CIA and military people to do operations. So you don't need a finding. You don't have any chain of authority or chain of command. You have a few people that know what's going on, and God knows what's being done. The system is very much out of control.
You know, this is a pretty frightening picture, to put it mildly.
It depends on how you feel about it. If you like Bush and Cheney and the way they behave and their views, you might think it's great.
Yeah, perhaps. But if you like constitutional rule, you might not.
If you're worried about, if you worry about things like a straight line between, let's say, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, Kyrgyzstan, Ukraine, Georgia, and how about Venezuela in the future, you're not going to like what's coming.
Because basically you're saying that the executive branch and the military are operating with less public or congressional oversight than ever before.
Look, the congressional oversight's been pathetic enough as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is inevitable because you have a Republican president, Republican Senate and House, and, of course, they kowtow. Much better if we had Democrats. But even so, my sad, pathetic little joke is on any given day I can't decide whether Congress is simply supine or simply prone.
We're talking to Seymour Hersh today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. A reminder, Seymour Hersh will be in town Tuesday night, 5 p.m., speaking in Folinger Auditorium, free and open to the public. It's the kickoff address for the Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation Conference. It'll be taking place Tuesday and Wednesday. He will also appear Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. on a panel concerning journalism. That will be in Krannert, all events free and open to the public. If you want to learn more about that conference, simply go to www.iimpr.org, imper.org. Got the full schedule there, and I hope you will be able to attend it. We have a full bank of phone calls, and I plan to get to all of them. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Seymour Hersh.
Hello. Just wanted to expand, kind of already took a back step and went over this, but I wanted to point out that personally I think it's a mistake to take the administration's stated position and say, well, they believe this. You were kind of doing that about whether or not Bush believes he's a good guy, and you were doing it about saying, you know, well, Bush believes he's in democracy, and then directly stated of just this huge subversion of democracy here, and not even getting into the idea that people can't even see the president speak without signing loyalty oaths. People would not believe this 10 years ago. Anyway, I just wanted to kind of point out that I think it's a mistake to use this kind of language, to borrow their language, say, well, they must believe in this because why else would they do it, and ignore all the evidence to the contrary.
Are you talking about like oil and support for Israel? Would you argue that we're in Iraq because ultimately it's about oil?
It's hard to say. It seems to me that Iraq was complicated enough that it was like, in a grim sort of way, a win-win-win situation. There were political points to be scored at home. There was the presence just in the Middle East. There was the oil payoff.
I would say that about Afghanistan, but Iraq was a stretch. Afghanistan, I think, even though believe it or not, inside the government there was a huge argument against going after everybody, the Taliban, uniformly, and not making distinctions between those in the Taliban who supported bin Laden and those who hated him. In any case, you're entitled to, you know, you may be dead right. I have no market on what the truth is. The only thing I can tell you is, boy, you know, I'm one of those people, you mentioned Kissinger, I'm convinced Henry Kissinger lies like most people breathe. Nonetheless, it would have been wonderful to have a Henry Kissinger in this administration because then you know if we were going into this madness of Iraq, there was something, and there was always a secret agenda with Henry Oil, personal power or whatever. The problem you have is I think the truth is that this guy really believes what he's doing, and if there's you know, I'll use this language. Wolfowitz would understand this, but President Bush might not. George Bush is probably the last of the great Trotskyites. He's a believer in permanent revolution. He doesn't understand history. He doesn't understand it, but he does understand the chaos in the Middle East. He thinks works for him. And and it's very scary when you have somebody as passionate and as committed to a radical reform as he is, you know, bringing democracy to Iraq.
But, you know, in fairness to the caller, maybe, who we've lost, I just want to, you know, I think maybe the point he's getting at is that this notion of democracy, that we're using this term, and you've pointed this out in your own work, is sort of hackneyed the way Bush applies it. I mean, it's contradictory.
Well, you know what the Russians said to me? One Russian said to me, we were talking all this pressure they're getting from us about democracy. And tell me, what is it you want, Western democracy or Eastern democracy? I mean, it's ludicrous. The only point I'm making is that... look, none of us have an answer to what's in this guy's mind. I'd love to think there was some other agenda in Iraq besides the one that seems to be there. Because if there was another agenda, as I say, a passionate conviction that this is important for Israel or the oil business, we got to get control of oil, it would give it some patina of sense. Because right now, it's simply crazy ideology without any information. It's sort of a super overdrive, hyperdrive madness going on.
What do you think right now, looking at where things stand in Iraq, where's this heading? I mean, what sort of impact is this going to have on the United States and the world 5, 10, 15 years
from now? Yeah, I was in Germany last week, and I was talking to some of the people there, and I was making this horrible, nobody laughed, sort of black humor, trying to make the light of it. Look, we can go in and muck up Iraq. Muck it up, destroy it, leave it in a total complete mess. And then we just say, okay, we've won, or whatever we're going to say. It's stable now, or there's a good government, and we'll just, you know, it'll be balkanized or whatever. And we just withdraw or get driven off. And we go back, and we have 3,000 miles of water, and it's not an existential issue for us. In Europe, for the French and the Germans and the people in the various small countries, in the Baltic area where they have enormous and very active Muslim minority populations that are very much agitating, it's a huge issue for them that we've come and stirred up this pot. And so they're much more worried. Look, nobody can tell you where it's going to go. The only good thing I can tell you in terms of the amount of simple garbage that emanates from this government in terms of what the reality is on the ground is that no matter how many times they tell us there's light at the end of the tunnel and things are okay and the election works, it's going to, you know, the old cliche is boots on the ground are going to decide this. And it's not going well at all. It's going much worse than they're telling you. It's not an insurgency. An insurgency suggests we've won something and people disagree with us. You know, we took the country and then there were factions, rebels that disagreed. We're fighting the war against the people we started against. You know, basically, the Ba'athists and the pro-Saddam and the Sunni party. The religious Sunni group in the central part of Baghdad, of Iraq, around Baghdad and the four provinces. We're fighting a war against those people. Yes, there are jihadists, there are Salafis, there's Wahhabis. They're certainly a factor. You know, we hear about Zarqawi, but the real people that are driving the resistance are the people we started the war against. They just didn't fight the war the way we wanted them to. They evacuated Baghdad and went to a guerrilla operation. And the only thing that's notable about all of this, it's been 2 years of a guerrilla war. We know nothing about them.
We're talking to Seymour Hersh today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show. If you'd like to call in, please do it, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Seymour Hersh, of course, the writer for The New Yorker, who writes on military and security matters. You can tell you're a native Chicagoan, it sounds like, by accent.
Yeah.
And
woof, woof, woof.
Yeah, I think our listeners can appreciate that. We've got a full bank of callers. Let's get back to them if we can. Line 2 on the cell phone, you're on the air with Seymour Hersh.
Oh, hello. Am I on the air?
You are indeed.
Mr. Hersh, thank you for your time.
No problem.
I'd like to give you my take on Iraq, please, and then I'll hang up and hear your comments.
What's your basis for the attack? Are you ad hominem? Do you serve there or something like that?
In Iraq? No, yeah. I happen to be a veteran from Vietnam, as a matter of fact.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I see a parallel, and I see both foundations of the wars based on fear. Vietnam based on fear of communism, Iraq based on a fear of the unknown. After 9/11, I see the administration backed against the wall. They were concerned. Did this guy have them? Did he not have weapons of mass destruction? And fear drove that war. Democracy, the thought of democracy in the country came much later. We had to come up with an idea of, now what do we do? But I really believe, and I think if you think it through, that was the motivation of invading Iraq. Now, I'd like to hear your comments, and if you don't mind, I'm in the car here. I'll just hang up and listen, okay?
Okie dokie.
You could well be right. Of course, nobody, you know, as I said earlier, we just don't know what's in the mind. This president is very hidden from us. We don't know how much he's directly involved. I have a hunch, since most presidents who are in the middle of a war are terribly involved daily and, you know, up to the minute and always available to be briefed on stuff, I have a hunch the same thing happens for this president. I don't think he's as detached as he might seem. But in any case, we don't know. There's no question fear was enormously important after 9/11. If you remember, about a month afterwards, there was a rumor that there was something going to happen in Chicago, and I think they evacuated the Sears Tower. We didn't know whether the crazies, the Osama bin Laden, and by the way, the full story of Al-Qaeda and how much, Osama bin Laden, we don't really have the whole story. There's a lot of assumptions made about Al-Qaeda. Turns out to be a phrase that has been in circulation. It's a generic Arabic phrase that's been around since the early 80s. And it's not clear that bin Laden called himself Al-Qaeda till after 2001, and we began to put so much attention into him. It's not clear how much it was really. Anyway, it's just a lot we don't know is the point.
Along those lines, can I just interrupt? Because this thing about bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, is a very important point, but we don't know. I mean, if we were to take out bin Laden, does this movement collapse?
Oh, no. And the other thing that's really important is that a lot of people, I mentioned I was in Europe, I was talking to a lot of people who, in the people who in the business who follow this stuff in Europe, who of course have much better control of the language, and they're much closer. When you're closer to something, it's more of a, as I said, more of an existential issue. And there's a, you know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was a guy arrested a couple of years ago in Pakistan. It seems clear he was the main driving idea behind using airplanes, and not bin Laden. Bin Laden was sort of a paymaster who dispensed advice, and you would go to him for money because he had it. But it seems like it's all very much loosely drawn, and the idea that bin Laden's controlling anything is ludicrous. The things that happened in Spain are believed to have been totally independent. The blowing up of that last year of the train had nothing to do. What we're seeing is crazy action being done, but independently. There's no hyperdrive center. But to get back to your guys' question, I can guarantee fear had a lot to do with Afghanistan. And also the idea you had to respond in some way. And it was one reason we mistreated people so much, is we were so afraid. Part of being frightened is to be angry, too. And anyway, I don't know. It seems to me Iraq's a little different. I see a lot of stuff written by I mentioned Richard Pearl at the opening of the show and other neoconservatives. Who had their sights on bin Laden right after the first Gulf War. By 92, 93, 94, there was a lot of writing among the, at that time, fringe group of neoconservatives that the only solution in the Middle East has to begin with Saddam, that Saddam is the key. And that seems to have been something that drove the process all the way. But it could have been fear, too. I don't presume to know.
We've got a full bank of callers, Seymour Hersh, but before we get to them, I do want you to just talk briefly, if you would, about the torture in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. I mean, this is an extraordinary charge against the American government and American people. And we've gone through the process now of Lindy England being her charges, I think, being dropped or her plea not being accepted. What is your sense of what's taking place with regard to torture by the U.S. government and how it's being prosecuted?
Well, my sense is that Bush wins this whole war, unlike My Lai, in which there was an enormous revulsion. Eventually, it took time, but there was a prosecution of Lieutenant Calley. But in a way, the My Lai had the same sort of pattern, which is all the senior officers who knew so much about it got off. I wrote a second book about My Lai called Cover Up. That I did it for the New Yorker. I was working for the New Yorker way back in the early 70s, too, before he joined the New York Times. And I wrote a book about it, but, you know, it's one of those tough issues because it's hard to look at the institution, the United States military, which has so many good people in it. You know, I'm one of those people, I work closely with guys in the intelligence community, in the military, and I have a great deal of respect for the good ones. They're terrific, and they care as much about civil rights and the Constitution as anybody listening here and me and you. People in the FBI, I know, and the agencies, they really are competent, many, many, many of them. On the other hand, you have an institution that, you know, has been asked since Abu Ghraib, since the first discovery, or I wrote about this a year ago. CBS also published some pictures at the same time. I wasn't alone. They were there, too. The response has just been totally a total win for the Bush administration. The American public, it wasn't raised by John Kerry in the campaign for whatever reason. And we have to applaud his wisdom because he's president now, right? I don't know why he didn't want to do it. He just wanted to take on the year. You know, it was the one issue that could have elected him, I thought. But anyway, of course I would think that because I'd written the story. So it doesn't matter. But he wins in the way that there's been no really systematic look at why so much torture is going on. Forget Abu Ghraib and forget Iraq. What about Guantanamo? What about the stories about Afghanistan, Bagram, the prisons there that come out? And long before I wrote my stories, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International were putting out report after report blasting the government for its treatment of prisoners. And right now I will tell you it's still horrible. Iraqis are doing terrible things to the prisoners they're collecting, and we're still disappearing people. There's a fancy word this government uses for the, you know, it's called rendition,
yeah.
Which is really, rendition means you go into a country covertly, our boys do, our military guys do, go into somebody's house, drag them up by the hair, take them to someplace illegally without visa, without exit visas, get them on a private plane, fly them to someplace where the sun don't shine, and beat the hell out of them. Sometimes they die, sometimes they don't. That's called rendition. It's called missing and disappearing people in Argentina and Brazil two decades ago. It was a scandal. It's not here. And one of the things that's also, let me just say, as long as I'm on my soapbox, in any given society, the idea that the United States Senate and the House of Representatives will not begin extensive investigations into this completely total violation of international law. You know, one thing we learned in the Second World War, the Geneva Convention worked. It saved an awful lot of lives. We respect the foreign prisoners. They respect even the Germans to a great degree, as long as you weren't Jewish, treated our prisoners and all prisoners with reason. And many survived because of the Geneva Convention. And for us to throw it away as cavalierly as we did in this war and for the president to have knowingly done it before the election and not suffer says a lot, I guess, about, I don't know what it says a lot about. It's pretty nerve-wracking.
Well, what does it say about our media, our news media, that if politicians don't talk about it, they simply don't talk about it, they won't raise the issue either?
Well, the press has a tough time because I'm not sympathetic to the press after 9/11. I think they were scared to death, and they all joined the team, and they were terrified to be critical. I don't think there's any question. I think they all have, the New York Times and Washington Post have written mea culpas. And also on WMD, the idea that everybody believed it, that you want to hear from the politicians. Yes, I know Bill Clinton and his national security advisor, Sandy Berger, and the President Bush and his national security advisors believed it. But I will tell you that as of 1998, and I did a lot of reporting on this for The New Yorker, too, even back then, the United Nations, the UN teams, the UNSCOM inspection teams had concluded there was nothing there in terms of nuclear weapons, for sure. And also the international IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, the watchdog, which is certainly in the last few years shown to be a much more competent watchdog than we thought. You know, it's dealing very toughly and correctly with Iran. They wrote a report in 1997, almost as definitive as any UN agency could ever get, saying there's nothing there. The State Department Intelligence Branch, INR, that's been in the news so much with Bolton, those young aides, analysts who are very competent, they said there was nothing there in terms of nuclear. The Department of Energy has a very good intelligence branch. They monitor proliferation. They don't only make bombs, but in Sandia, Livermore, and Los Alamos, the big factories and laboratories in the West, they also have a very highly classified intelligence unit that check on, a proliferation around the world. They concluded there was nothing there. So it isn't such a laydown that everybody was so sure Saddam had the bomb. Everybody wanted to believe it. They believed it. But the truth is, There were many people inside our government and certainly around the world that knew there was nothing there.
You're listening to Seymour Hersh today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Seymour Hersh will be in town Tuesday night, 5 p.m. in Folinger Auditorium, giving the keynote address on the conference, Can Freedom of the Press Survive Media Consolidation? It is free and open to the public. He will also be speaking at 9 a.m. on Wednesday morning in Cranard, again, free and open to the public. If you want information on this event, go to www.iimpr.org, imper.org, with the full schedule of events and all the participants. It is an experience I think you'll all want to attend to, as many of the people speaking there will be people you've heard on this program over the past 6-10 weeks, actually over the past several years. So we have a full bank of phone callers, and I'm going to get to all of you. I'll do my best. Line 3 for Ina, you're on the air with Seymour Hersh.
Hi, it's a pleasure to speak to a real journalist, and I think if people aren't worried, they're not aware what's going on with this administration. I think it's frightening that we've got a president who's declared a preemptive policy against Iraq and has his button on the nuclear arsenal. What would be your comments on somehow removing him from office before the next election? And do you have another comment possibly on the electronic voting machine cover-up? Thank you.
Okay.
I don't think that, you know, look, I think the truth of the matter is what? We've got 1,350 or so more days with this guy. And the only good news is tomorrow we'll have one day less. I don't think anything's going to happen, certainly not with a Republican Congress. And there could be some changes. I think you're going to see an interesting election next year in the midterm elections. I think there's going to be an awful lot of different candidates. I think the Democratic Party has lost so much steam that there's going to be a lot of independent movements. They'll have to be nominally Democratic, but it's going to be an interesting campaign, the congressional campaign. And the voting machine stuff is really very troubling. I just, I think Bush won the election. I don't think there's enough evidence there to suggest he didn't, which is sad in itself, although there's a lot of problems in Ohio. But you're not going to get, that's a horse that's no sense in beating. But I do worry about the notion of putting so much faith in machines. And I don't know what we're going to do. But once again, this is another example. It's been, 5 years now since the horrible mess with the Supreme Court in the 2000 election, and we still haven't really systematically begun to deal with it.
Okay, we're talking to Seymour Hersh today, Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Seymour Hersh.
Yeah, good afternoon. I just want to quickly say that it really bothered me a lot about listening to this administration's talk, what they say, until I began to realize that what they mean by democracy equals corporate capitalism, and I'll hang up and let you discuss that. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I don't know what's in their mind. Democracy, this is, like most Republican governments, very much more friendly to the corporate world and the high finance world. And in every way, Bush gets a lot of breaks in the world. I will tell you, here we are. Of all the problems we have, the increase in the fuel is regressive because, what does the yuppie SUV driving crowd care about if they pay another $5 or $10? There's a lot that many who do not. It's just marginal income. But, when you're talking about people who drive vehicles, cabs or trucks, it's very regressive. And he doesn't seem to suffer any political consequences from it. The high oil also does one other factor. We have to borrow $2 billion a day in front of a falling dollar. So if you're like in Asia, the South Koreans and the Japanese are holding, something like more than $2 trillion of our debt. And every time the dollar goes down a few points, they lose 30 or 40 million a day. But it's doing all right now, the dollar. But the point is, right now, with all this oil money, we suddenly have all these people in the Middle East again, Kuwait, other countries, Brunei. The Saudis are buying our debt because they have so much, they're so liquid, they're flush with billions.
The point I think the caller is getting at, too, is that, we say this war is now about democracy is the common presentation. But as you've pointed out, there are countries in the Middle East that are not democracies, that are allies, that we have no interest in overthrowing those regimes or supporting efforts to overthrow them. And then you've got countries like Venezuela, which as far as I can tell, is one of the more popular governments in the history of South America after going through phenomenal attacks. And the U.S., instead of embracing it, saying, isn't it great to have democracy, is opposing that regime.
Well, you know, back to the days of the Cold War, you know, if you dare to challenge the United States, you got in trouble. You know, I've written about Nkrumah in Ghana, mm-hmm. who was killed in a coup that our CIA was, we didn't, you know, we were aware of it, and buttressed it. We may not have done the pull of the trigger, but we certainly had a lot to do with it, a lot of knowledge about it in advance. And so, you know, the Nkrumah's problem was he had refused to break off with communist China in the middle 60s, so we, you know, he was on the short list. You know, one nice thing about being an 800-pound gorilla, we can set the rules. And I don't think, to get back to the woman's comment, I think that there is a reflex towards large-scale, big money, but that's just a Republican reflex. I don't know. I don't know if he's. I don't know why he's doing what he's doing.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. And we've only got a few minutes left, and I've got a bunch of callers I want to get to. Line 4 in Central Illinois. You're on the air with Seymour Hirsch.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your comments. Considering the neocon people that are in the administration, is this not an Israeli agenda in Iraq thing?
Well, you know, it sure has a lot of, you know, you can argue it is, because what the president and the neocons say is if you get democracy in Iraq and you get which is one of the great enemies of Israel, and you get democracies in Iran, which is another great enemy of Israel, and in Syria, if you can, you know, change the politics, you will improve Israel's condition, obviously. It'll be, and then the neocon mantra, what they were saying before the Bush election, neocons would then argue if those three countries went, Iran, Iraq, and Syria went democratic, Israel would have less pressure and they could be more generous to the Palestinians and make them a better offer, not have such security concerns. I've heard all that. I also hear an awful lot about oil. And I also tell you that I think both of those are obviously factors. How could they not be? But the ultimate real issue for me and my, and you can really take issue with me because I didn't have a 20-minute conversation with President Bush about it. I really believe that he does believe this stuff. I mean, it's phenomenal. I think he really thought he could go into Iraq with few troops, overthrow Saddam, and water, you know, democracy would flow like water from the fountains and spread all over the Middle East. It hasn't worked out that way. And Israel isn't much safer for what's going on right now in Iraq in the long run, because you'll see probably the spread of Iranian-style government into much of Iraq, certainly the southern part. I think Sistani is going to, I don't think there's any question, Syria wins big in what's going on right now. And that's not good for us, and it's not good for Israel.
We're talking to Seymour Hirsch today in Media Matters. One week from today in Media Matters, our guest will be Victor Nevasky, a longtime editor of The Nation magazine with a new book out on independent media. 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Tim Robbins, the actor and filmmaker, discussing his work, his new play, Embedded. And then 3 weeks from today, our guest will be Greg Palast, the investigative journalist. So stay tuned to Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Seymour Hirsch.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. You were talking earlier a lot about the sort of more centralized methods of dealing with terrorism, less oversight and so on. And Americans seem to have a traditional skepticism towards governments, even on the left and on the right, suspicion of the state. I was wondering if you think there's a critical mass to where people will see enough of this exposed, will be so fearful of some of the prescriptions of civil rights that they might actually start demanding something politically be changed, or it might have a reaction against the current administration. Thanks.
Oh, man, I hope so. I mean, that seems to be a logical recourse that at some point. But it's, you know, look, I don't expect the American press to lead it. You know, like all the American press is, you know, it's, you know, we're not very good on this stuff. You know, we'll be about 6 months behind any new social trends. So when this does happen, it's not going to be the press that's going to be a player in this. And that's been traditional. You know, people get their heart broken by the press all the time, but I do think you're going to see much more political agitation, particularly if this war keeps on going at the rate it's going and gets worse, as it seems to be inevitably it will. But it hasn't happened yet.
From your work, Seymour Hirsch, talking to people in the intelligence and military community and your sources, do you sense that among people who might traditionally be regarded as conservatives, even Republicans, say, historically, that there's an element of concern in that community that's greater than usual with this administration?
Oh, my God, yes. One of the horribly frightening things for me is, or disconcerting thing for me, the number, look, I talk to people. I was just talking about this issue yesterday with some guy that's a 4-star, you know, a senior general who's very disconcerted. The problem you have is there are a number of people in the Senate, Republicans in the Senate, who privately are scathing about the administration. But so far, publicly, I'm not talking about this guy in Ohio that stood up on the Bolton case. I'm talking about other people that are, you know, nominal Republicans, well-known Republicans, with some with ambitions, who really privately revile this administration, but don't do much about it. And publicly, they stay in tune. We're going to need some huge demonstration of enormous courage. It's going to have to be by a Republican to stand up and say, it's time to say no. We haven't had it yet because, you know, there's a price to pay for that. These guys, this administration has a lot of money and a lot of power, and they can, you know, change, you know, impact on anybody's senatorial ambitions right now.
We've only got a few seconds left. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Farina, Illinois, you're on the air with Seymour Hersh.
Hi, thank you, Bob, for your great show, as always. And Seymour Hersh, what an honor it is to be able to talk to one of our great journalists. You were talking about the systematic torture not being looked at properly, and I'm feeling the same is true about 9/11. And particularly, I wanted to ask about the obstructionism of the Bush administration in the investigation and how there was a big whitewash and a lot of factors weren't looked into, and the fact that that's not being done, and what you thought about that. And also, when you broke the torture story, I was so hoping that there would be a crack in the facade that the American public's buying into, but it doesn't seem like that's really happened, and I wondered what you felt about that.
You know, Seymour, we only got about a minute and a half left. Maybe you ought to tackle that first one about
9/11. Let me just say quickly about Abu Ghraib. When you have no moral leadership at the top, it's very hard to make a moral judgment about something. And that's why I think John Kerry failed us, too, in the campaign. He chose not to raise that issue in terms of, look, what it's a question not only of the problem with Abu Ghraib. It's not only a question of what happens to them, but the victims also are soldiers who do it. I mean, they're as much victims in a sense. I mean, you know, the job of the military is, you know, in loco parentis, you know, to protect these kids we see on trial from doing stupid things. And instead, the officers stood around and watched. So we don't know the whole story. It's not going to be very good when it comes out. On the first issue, or what was the question?
About 9/11 and the Bush administration obstructing the investigation.
Of course, I think there's no question the Bush administration was terrified about some of the memos that were written. Some came out. They didn't have the impact they thought they might before the election. This Dick Clark knew a lot and was writing about it in his book. I think the public, for whatever reason, probably because they didn't want Kerry. You know, and the thing that's most disheartening is many Americans chose not to learn, because if you really study the issues about WMD and the whole question of going to Iraq in response to 9/11, if you really looked at it, you couldn't elect this guy. And so the reason you see all these polls, it seems to me, my guess is showing that so many people still think Saddam had something to do with 9/11 or terrorism, is because they think the other they'd have to not vote for Kerry, and they didn't want to vote for Kerry. It's a sad predicament we're in.
Seymour Hersh, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means it's time for me to clear out of the studio. Thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
Okay.
And we look forward to welcoming you Tuesday night, 5 o'clock, in Folinger Auditorium here in beautiful Urbana, and your speech free and open to the public. And look forward to seeing you then. Thank you for joining us. And listeners, see you in 167 hours.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high in the mid-80s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, becoming cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The low in the lower 60s with south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely. The high in the mid-70s with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, made possible by the support of our listeners, the friends of WILL. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.